So we're continuing our journey through the Gospel of John, and today we are at chapter 11. We're going to be talking about the resurrection of Lazarus. To our video audience, good to have you with us. I haven't been watching the numbers on that lately, and last week I checked when I posted the video from last Sunday, and there were 3,500 views. And I think that's insane. That can't possibly be. I wonder if people just turn it on until they fall asleep or what. But anyway, our video audience, thanks for tuning in. The photograph you see in front of you is from the first time I'd ever seen an open tomb like that. That's at the Bellmead Plantation near Nashville. We were in Nashville, and since, you know, I don't like country music, I thought we had to see the other sites there. Nashville has a replica of the Parthenon right across the street from Vanderbilt University. It's really interesting to see, too, if you're into Greek history. But so this is the plantation owners there. They have a mansion on the plantation. It still has bullet holes in the pillars from the Civil War. And it's just kind of an interesting thing to see. They have slave shacks, and you can actually take a guided tour through the mansion. And that's interesting. And then I was just looking around to see if there are other tombs like this. You know, I've been to New Orleans and seen the tombs above the ground. But this one's fascinating, and I've never been to this one yet. That is George Washington's tomb on Mount Vernon. And I really want to see that. I'm not going to get there this year, but it's on my bucket list. I want to see that place. Just to see Mount Vernon, and like that, like Bellmead in Nashville, only much bigger. George Washington had apparently made his money by the old-fashioned way by inheriting it, and then he had tobacco and slaves. And anyway, that's where George and Martha are buried, and I want to see it. But death is definitely an unpleasant topic. People don't like it. I've talked about it, and almost every time that I've done a baccalaureate for Reese Puffer, I've brought it up, because I want kids to live their lives knowing that they're not going to live forever. And so I just make a little quip in the baccalaureate speech that the mortality rate of people born in Muskegon County is 100%. Everybody's going to die. And I tell you what, I got chewed out for that a couple of times. You shouldn't be talking about death at a baccalaureate. Okay, yeah, we'll talk about how they're all going to live forever and become wealthy and wise and all that stuff. But that's not the case. And I think it's important to live with the realization that we're temporaries here. And nobody likes to think about death. I'm approaching 70 myself. I've already lived longer than my grandfathers have lived. I've conducted over 500 funerals just because of my job. You know, I walk through Laketon Cemetery. It feels like a class reunion. About, seems like every other grave in there is one that I've officiated over. But death isn't talked about too much. I believe, folks, that the church is the place to talk about it, because Jesus talks about it. And my goal is to make you all into Bible scholars. I asked the consistory if they were okay with that, and they said they were. So I want you all to be up on what the Bible teaches about death. You know, my pastoral duties have placed me front and center with death. And after 43 years, it still triggers these emotions in me. When I did Mick Myers' service here a little over a week ago, I had this big old lump in my throat the whole time. And I thought about it, but it still comes that way even after all these years and all these times. I think the most interesting time, and one of our faithful video viewers was present when this happened, but I was praying for a woman in a nursing home. She was near death, natural causes. She had all five of her children there, and they were all adults, and she asked me to pray for her, which I did, and by the time I was done with the prayer, she had died. And I thought, what a cool way to go. You know, there she was, all her kids around her, praying, and, you know, the conversation never had to end. because she had checked out. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. But, you know, we have to remind ourselves, especially, you know, people my age, we're in the last quarter of the game. It's not going to go forever. One of my heroes is this fella here, Keith Richards. You see what he looked like in 65 and then again in 25. He's been doing a lot of interviews lately because he had to cancel a tour because of his arthritis. And he says, you know, I realize my time is running out. He's 83. Well, we've all lost someone that we care about, but we don't want to talk about death. Churches, after all, are supposed to be inspirational. I had a guy tell me that once. He said to me, I'm really disappointed. He was disappointed in me because he wanted to be inspired. I said, well, you want me to lie to you? He goes, yeah. I said, you want me to avoid certain subjects? He said, yes. I said, so you want a church that's basically like the Hallmark Channel that tells you nice mushy stuff and makes you feel good? And he goes, yeah. And so then I invited him to become a Methodist. He's not here anymore. Death is a painful subject, but Jesus does talk about death, and it is inevitable. Jesus teaches us how to handle it. He sees death as the beginning of a new life that's eternal and good. Now, the Gospel of John was put together by this fellow named John, and he had a team of researchers with him. He had to have because of that, of just how it's constructed. And it's very interesting how John is put together, you know, the seven signs and all that, if you read it in context, which I'm hoping to portray to you. But if the Greek, you know, everything was written in Greek in those days because, you know, Alexander the Great had conquered that area and imposed the Greek language on everybody. And so that's why the New Testament's written in Greek. And the Greek of the Gospel of John is very, very simple compared to the rest of the New Testament. They believe that's because John wanted it to be read to everybody. So he put it in this simple Greek because his intention was to have this gospel read aloud. It's not intended to be read. It's intended to be listened to. And that does make sense as you go through it. Today we're going to listen to the story of Lazarus. Now, the story is only found in the Gospel of John. The other three don't mention it, which is curious. And different New Testament scholars have wondered why that is. And mostly they say it's because Lazarus was probably still alive and the Pharisees wanted him dead. So that's why they just didn't mention him in their Gospels. But anyway, here's the story. A man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. This is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. So the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. But when Jesus heard about it, he said, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. So although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Finally, he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. So he was getting ready to make another visible sign. You all know what Judea, you know, is in the south, separated from Galilee by Samaria, which we talked about with the woman at the well. So the narrative goes on here. But his disciples objected. Rabbi, they said, only a few days ago the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again? Jesus replied, there are 12 hours of daylight every day. During the day, people can walk safely. They can see because they have the light of this world. But at night, there is danger of stumbling because they have no light. Then he said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. But now I will go and wake him up. See, it was dangerous for Jesus to be in the south, to be in Judea. But he's telling his people, let the light shine while it can. Now, if you are following this along in the Gospel of John, you know that the theme of light and darkness is in just about every chapter, of Jesus being the light and the world trying to snuff him out. And here he uses sleeping as a metaphor for death, of course. Now, the disciples said, "Lord, if he is sleeping, he'll soon get better." They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant Lazarus had died. So he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there. For now you will really believe. Come, let's go see him." See, this would be a definite sign then, you know. I mean, if you doubted that Jesus could raise somebody from the dead, and then you met Lazarus, it might reduce that doubt a little. You know, it'd just be kind of tough to say, no, that's not true. But there were people that doubted. Thomas, nicknamed the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let's go too and die with Jesus." Now, tradition has it that Thomas looked like Jesus. His nickname was Didymus, which in Greek means the twin. Some thought he was the resurrected Christ for a while. After Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, they thought Thomas was him because they looked alike. But Thomas was a skeptical pessimist, and that's kind of endearing about him. So the narrative goes on. When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Bethany was only a few miles down the road from Jerusalem, and many of the people had come to console Martha and Mary in their loss. When Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. But Mary stayed in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you want." See, so this Mary gal is a little manipulative. You know, "Oh, if only you had been here." They're trying to make Jesus feel guilty. But yet she trusted him. And this is how he responds to her. Jesus told her, "Your brother will rise again." "Yes," Martha said, "he'll rise when everyone else rises at the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha?" So, you know, what Jesus is doing here is he's addressing a general belief of the Pharisees. We don't know where they got this from, but they believed that if you died, you got put in the ground, then somehow there's a last day, a judgment day coming where the angels would blow trumpets and everybody shoot up out of their graves, kind of like Pop-Tarts out of a toaster. And then you'd be judged. And that's kind of what they thought it was going to be. Now, Jesus knows that's not the way it's going to be because, you know, he's in charge. But he still kind of prattles down to these Pharisees from time to time. You know, but here he makes it pretty plain the Pharisees got it wrong. Because he says, "You'll never die if you trust in me." Remember the thief on the cross. It's the most plain one, you know, where Jesus says, "Today you're going to be with me in paradise. You're not going to lay in the ground for a couple thousand years. Today you're going to be with me in paradise." And, you know, the Apostle Paul, as his theology matured, his most mature writing on death is from 2 Corinthians 5, where he talks about our bodies being an earthly tent that needs to be taken down so that we can have a new tent for our souls. Now, coincidentally, you know, I was conducting a graveside service one time, and you know how funeral homes will set up tents, especially if the weather's bad. And this particular day, it was windy as the dickens. It was kind of half raining. And I got to that part of 2 Corinthians 5, which I like to read at times like that. It says, "And when this earthly tent is taken down, a gust of wind came along and took that tent about four rows over." And there was a highly chagrined funeral director. Poor guy had to wake up halfway through the service. But it was quite comical to see. As the story goes on like this, Yes, Lord, she told him, I've always believed you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come into the world from God. Then she returned to Mary. She called Mary aside from the mourners and told her, the teacher is here and wants to see you. So Mary immediately went to him. And notice she calls him the teacher, which is a highly respected title. And then when he says what he does to her, she simply obeys him. She immediately went to him. Those are just some things to note. Jesus had stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. When the people who were at the house consoling Mary, they saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus' grave to weep. So they followed her there. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. Again, it's like she's trying to make Jesus feel guilty for her brother's untimely death while acknowledging his power to heal. I've seen that many times. People say, well, if God's in charge, why am I suffering like this? And I have the perfect answer for all of that. I don't know. That's above my pay grade. Or as one of our former elders, Ken Hooker, used to say, we'll just have to ask him when we get there. Because I don't know the answer to that. Okay, here we go. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. Where have you put him? He asked them. So now this passage here, you know, you got to translate it from the Greek. And I think instead of a deep anger, it should be a deep frustration. You know, anger comes from unmet expectations. You know, you expect somebody to drive decently and they don't, and you get angry. But this was different than a stimulus and response type of anger. This anger shows that Jesus was frustrated and saddened by death. The Greek word is embrimisthai. Embrimisthai, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. But it's a word that's used for a horse that snorts. You know how when horses get excited, you know that, they got this. Can you make the sound for us? Yeah, not right now. I'd make it, but I don't want to show off. You know, but I used to have this quarter horse that would do that. He'd get excited, you know, like he'd be approaching a yard of cattle and he'd love to chase the cattle. So he'd get close to the yard and he'd stand there and he'd snort and all that. And that horse liked 7-Up. We used to have 7-Up in glass bottles and I would let him drink out of a glass bottle. I'd just hold it up and he'd come drink it just like a calf, you know. And one time I got it in his nose, the bubbly 7-Up, and talk about a horse snorting. Man, he snorted like crazy. But, you know, Jesus is troubled here, and I think we can understand why. See, no matter what we do, the devil eventually gets our body. You know, eventually our bodies return to the earth that they're made from. That just happens. Jesus, as the creator of the human body, has to watch bodies deteriorate, get old, die, and return to the earth. He most likely was pretty disgusted with that. But humans, our ancestors, made a deal with the devil, so they get our flesh. Our flesh will be destroyed. And as the passage goes on, and this is, I think, one of the most important ones in the New Testament. They told him, Lord, come and see. Then Jesus wept. The people who were standing nearby said, see how much he loved him. But some said, this man healed a blind man. Could he have not kept Lazarus from dying? Now, at verse 35, I think is the most powerful verse in all of the Bible, that Jesus wept. Because he knows what you're feeling, and he's going to empathize with it. To me, that says it all. That's the gospel in three words. And the word then is actually not in the Greek. It's just in the Greek. It just says Jesus wept. But very interesting. I think it's that, was Jesus saddened by the death? He knew what death was, and he knew what the next life was. But I think he was saddened by the pain felt by Lazarus' sisters. You know, if you stand at a funeral service with somebody who's lost their loved ones and they're weeping, you naturally weep with them. You know, unless you've got psychopathic tendencies or something, where you can't feel it, but you naturally weep with them. And here Jesus had emotions strong enough to produce tears. And I think that's one of the coolest things in the New Testament. The narrative goes on. Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. "Roll the stone aside," Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, protested. "Lord, he's been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible." You know, now, the Jews had this belief, too. It's another one of their stranger beliefs, that when you died for 3 days, your soul hovered above your body. And that's why they had wakes for 3 days. But on the fourth day, your soul was released, and death was definitely permanent. The soul could not re-enter the body. And so that's why they said the fourth day was proof that Lazarus was actually dead. And then there would have been the deterioration of the body, of course, because that just happens. Jesus responded, "Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe?" So they rolled the stone aside. Then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, "Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me. But I said it out loud for the sake of all those people standing here, so that they will believe you sent me." Then Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." You know, hence the title of this is A Tomb with a View, because they got to see God's power. Just picture it, picture being there and seeing this thing. It had to be life-changing. I had lots of discussions about death with this old boy. This is one of my teachers from Western Seminary, John Pete, and I hung around him when he was dying. He had pancreatic cancer. And, he said to, actually his wife was dying at the time. She died before he did. He said, you know, the firm believer, and this guy's a firm believer. He was a seminary professor. He did 30 years as a missionary in India, had a heart attack, and came back and taught in the seminary. But he said, you know, the atheist and the Christian and the Muslim, we're all alike at the point of death, and that we really don't know for sure what's going to happen to us. There's always that doubt. He says, but we can know something by faith. You know, what Jesus did for us. Because Jesus demonstrated that he has the power over death, you will live on too. You'll meet your loved ones, those that you've just recently lost. You'll be seeing them in the future, because your future is nailed down by Jesus. You'll see your children. You'll meet your great-grandparents, and you'll probably meet your great-grandchildren after a few years. So it's important that you trust Jesus to save you. This guy was instrumental in pushing that on me, and I promised him I'd push it on whoever came to listen to me for the rest of my life. And that's what I'm doing now. You know, he said that trust is so important. And I've used this chair metaphor, you know, just as you trust the chair to hold you up, so you trust Jesus to save you. Nobody's sitting on a chair that's about to collapse right now. Just think of that chair. And then imagine that chair on an airplane. I've seen this a few times where somebody, especially on the first time flying, they freak out, you know, when that plane gets up to speed on the, whatever you call it, the takeoff. Now, the end result is the same. You know, the plane lands, you're okay. You can either be calm or you can freak out with the flight. That's your choice. Jesus is saying, trust him. Now, I think of that, and I've told this story before, a story of Millie Feet, who was a regular here for years, and she struggled so much with death. Her death was very painful. She had a lot of things to go through. And one of the times I went to see her, I said, "So what do you think about here all day?" And she was in a hospice bed, and she said, "You know, I think about your red chair. Think about putting my trust in Jesus all the time." And then she died, and we talked about that. And the interesting thing is her husband, Dick, donated those two chairs that are sitting in the entryway now as a reminder of the significance of the chair. We're called to trust Jesus the way he trusted God. On the cross, he said, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Now, just like these people on the airplane, you can trust in him at the point of death or not trust him. That's what John Pete pushed on us all the time. He says, "It's up to you. But which way is better? Is it better to have that calm, trusting faith or to have a mindless panic the whole time?" Well, I think the trusting faith is a better way to go. Now, I've seen it both ways. I've seen people dying without trusting Jesus, and I've seen people dying trusting Jesus. And there's no question which way is a better way to go. Here's my recommendation. Don't wait until the bell rings for you. See, it's going to ring. You never know when life's going to end, but you've got to be certain that it is going to end. So trust him now. When you do, the other things in life are better too. Trusting him will give you that peace every day. So until that day when you meet him face to face, and on that day when you trust him with your life, he will say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master." I want all of you to have a thorough understanding of what's going on in the Gospel of John. I want you to know this story of Lazarus. My recommendation is that this afternoon you look up John chapter 11. There's Bible Gateway online if you don't have a Bible at home. Click on the New Living Translation and you'll get what you just saw here. And I recommend that you let your life absorb this story of Lazarus, because it is that important. Would you pray with me, please? Lord, you try to teach us so many things through these stories. Now I ask that you make this story a part of all of our lives, so that we live our lives just simply trusting you, knowing that you're working things out for our best. So we commit our lives to you. In every way, we're reporting for duty. Amen.